From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this program we call Coast to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. A series of strong earthquakes struck a mountainous Tibetan area of Western China, killing more than 500 people. That number count will go way up, injuring more than 10,000 as houses made of mud and wood simply collapsed. Many more people trapped and the toll expected to rise. A volcano under a glacier in Iceland erupted Wednesday for the second time in less than a month, melting ice, spewing smoke and steam, closing a major road there and forcing hundreds of people to flee rising floodwaters. Authorities evacuated 800 people. Rivers rose by up to 10 feet. Can you believe that? Something strange in the cosmic neighborhood. An unknown object in the nearby galaxy M82 has started sending out radio waves, and the emission does not look like anything seen anywhere in the universe before. They're baffled. It certainly does not fit the pattern of radio emissions from a supernova. They usually get brighter over a few weeks and then fade away over months, with the spectrum of the radiation changing all the while. So this baffles them. We'll keep our eyes on this one. Two moves to be announced Thursday before a visit by the president at Cape Canaveral, Florida, designed to apparently counter criticism of the Obama administration's space plans as being low on detail, physical hardware, and local jobs. President Obama is set to pump an additional $6 billion, however, over the next 5 years into NASA's budget. Along with the budget increase, the president is expected to announce a revival of the NASA crew capsule concept that he had canceled with the rest of the moon program earlier this year, in a move that will mean more jobs and less reliance on the Russians. The space capsule called Orion still won't go to the moon. It will go unmanned to the International Space Station to stand by as an emergency vehicle to return astronauts home. And former astronaut Neil Armstrong has issued a very strongly worded rebuke of President Barack Obama, criticizing the president for proposed revisions to the space program. Armstrong, along with astronauts James Lovell and Eugene Cernan, called the proposal devastating. Our science advisor, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, has been monitoring this situation for a long, long time. Richard, I guess we'll find out soon enough, won't we?
Well, we're going to find out tomorrow afternoon at about 1:45 Eastern Time. That's when the president flies into the skid strip, the 15,000-foot runway that's there at Cape Canaveral in Air Force One. This has been held incredibly tightly, George. There are no leaks. I've got, you know, access through certain folks in Washington, and nothing is leaking out. I have one statement that came from a relatively reliable source, which is don't believe the outline that the White House put out a couple of days ago in terms mm-hmm. of what Obama is going to be announcing. And we will see whether that inside information comes true.
It would be all speculation, even the story I just had. They still, as you just said, Richard, nobody really knows what he's going to announce.
Well, the one thing we know is this is not a summit. You know, we just saw the nuclear summit. We know 2 days, leaders from around Washington, around the world, 49 leaders from 49 different countries. This is not what this is. This is going to be a presidential announcement. Then he will meet with workers at Cape Canaveral afterwards, and then he's going to go to a fundraiser for the Democratic Party, which apparently is also scheduled at the same time later in the afternoon and evening. We do not know the substance of the announcement, except we do know I have posted now on Enterprise the Phobos paper, part one and part two.
Good.
Everybody can go read, and they can see what we have found, which is this stunning artificial spaceship orbiting Mars called Phobos, the inner moon. Now, that information has come to us from the European Space Agency, from deep contacts. In fact, the one academic that we have been in touch with through our intermediaries is sending two delegates to be part of Obama's space summit, to be in the audience in Florida tomorrow afternoon, yet no one knows what's going to be announced, and all we can do is watch, wait, look carefully, and ask lots of questions afterwards.
All right, we'll get your reaction Thursday, Richard, and also, can you give me a quick update on what's going on with the International Space Station?
Well, we've got a problem on one side of the cooling. As you know, this mission was to replace an ammonia tank. which doesn't sound very exciting, but it's basically crucial for cooling. It's like having a big refrigerator. And when they got everything installed and flipped the switch, half of the cooling is now not working, and they've traced it down to a valve in a nitrogen tank, which they are thinking now of a fourth spacewalk, extending the mission another day, a fourth spacewalk to have astronauts literally go out and swap out that tank and the valve inside, and they haven't rehearsed and practiced anything, so it's going to be kind of interesting to see how they pull this off.
Okay, we'll get your reaction tomorrow to this presidential announcement regarding NASA's budget. Thank you, Richard. U.S. military officials say the U.S. Army will court-martial a lieutenant colonel who refuses to deploy to Afghanistan because he considers orders from President Obama to be illegal. He's an Army doctor. Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lacken believes President Obama does not meet the constitutional requirements to be president and commander-in-chief because he believes that Mr. Obama was not born in the United States. Lacken refused this week to report to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, for deployment to Afghanistan, but instead showed up at the Pentagon, where he was confronted by his brigade commander, Colonel Gordon Roberts, a Vietnam Medal of Honor recipient. Lacken was informed by Roberts that he would face court-martial. Under fire from Republican critics, Attorney General Eric Holder said the U.S. still aims to capture and interrogate Osama bin Laden, but expects that the al-Qaeda leader won't be taken alive. The U.S. government is not fully guarding, apparently, against the contamination of meat by traces of antibiotics, pesticides, or heavy metals, according to a new report. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Inspector General said federal agencies have failed to set limits on many potentially harmful chemical residues, which has resulted in meat with these substances being distributed to us. Jeff Nelkin, our food safety expert, on the line with us. So I guess what they're saying, Jeff, is it's still not too safe, is it?
Well, there are a lot of questions, and, you know, one of the issues, especially since we have a lot of meat that goes to our school system, you know, we're talking about a little additional testing, and we're just trying to even push the government to spend a penny a pound to make the meat that much safer for our children.
What are we going to do to get safer food?
It's going to take a movement of the people to finally push people in Washington to say, you know, we're tired of, you know, the meat that's being sent to our kids in the schools. Why can't you spend an extra penny or two a pound to make the meat as safe as the meat you would buy at any of your fast food restaurants?
How about cooking your meat well done? Will that help at all?
Well, absolutely. When you're talking about ground beef, if you cook it to 155, you know, you'll kill the E. coli, and that's the bacteria that, you know, is the one we're facing.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com, part of our Twitter feed at Coast to Coast AM. Toyota Motor Corporation is temporarily halting sales of the story we reported on last night of the 2010 Lexus GX 460 after Consumer Reports issued a very rare don't buy warning amid concerns that the large SUV was handling problems that could cause it to roll over during sharp turns. The Japanese lawmakers have been looking at this as well, and the automaker, Toyota, says that it had asked dealers to temporarily suspend sales of the SUV while it conducts its own tests on the GX 460. A record number of U.S. homes were lost to foreclosure in the first 3 months of this year, a sign that banks are starting to wade through the backlog of troubled home loans at a faster pace, according to a new report. The radiocarbon dating that concluded the Shroud of Turin was a medieval forgery has been called into question now by a new study published by the Italian Society of Statistics, claiming the results contain huge inconsistencies. The article, authored by three Italian university-based statisticians and a professor of statistics from the London School of Economics, was published in Italian April 7th magazines. The authors challenged the results of the 1988 radiocarbon testing performed at the University of Oxford, the University of Arizona, and the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, and published in 1989 in Nature magazine. They charged that upon subsequent, more thorough testing, the results failed to reach the level of statistical significance needed to establish with 95% confidence, as was originally claimed from the 1988 tests, that the Shroud of Turin was a medieval creation. Jerry Corsi, who was just on with us on Easter, author of The Shroud Codex, Jerry, I guess this vindicates a lot of people who believe the Shroud of Turin is indeed the cloth that Jesus wore.
This is an important study, George, because it does go over the data of the radiocarbon testing for the three laboratories and these highly qualified university statisticians have determined that the various dates attributed there were systematic sources of error in the data. And they pointed to two sources of error. One was that the samples had traveled and had centuries of contact with human hands and traveled in different lands, and that even the Nobel Prize chemist, Willard Frank Libby, who created the carbon-14 dating method, had warned that factors like this could contaminate the results. And secondly, a major study by Ray Rogers, who was a chemist with the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, and he was a member of the 1978 Shroud of Turin Research Project. At the end of his life, Ray Rogers determined that the sample that had been selected of the shroud for the radiocarbon testing was contaminated by reweaving with medieval cotton. This had been done in 1534 to repair damage in 1532 fire. The Poor Clare nuns had repaired the shroud by reweaving cotton into the corner parts from which the sample of the radiocarbon was taken. So in other words, the radiocarbon results and the statistical analysis now shows the inconsistencies could be attributed to the medieval cotton and also the contamination from handling the shroud, given the results that the shroud was medieval in date, when in reality it could have been much older.
What's your gut tell you, Jerry, about the shroud?
My gut tells me, George, and continues to, the shroud is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ. There's never been a satisfactory explanation for how the image was formed. As I point out in the Shroud Codex, there's a convergence with even the most advanced particle physics today, looking at the three-dimensional nature of the image on the shroud, the possibility of multi-dimensional universes and simultaneous parallel universes existing, n-dimensional space, such that the figure of Jesus in the shroud could have transitioned from one dimension to another. A phenomenon the scientists describe, a flash of radiant light burning the image onto the shroud, which sounds to believers like myself very much like the traditional description of the resurrection.
Well, I got to tell you, Jerry, if this indeed did happen that way, it's one of the greatest stories we've ever heard. Thank you, Jerry. A Swiss actor, as part of our coasttocoastam.com feature story, is carving out a new career as a sinister-looking clown, terrifying children's birthday parties. Dominic Delville had the brainwave after watching his favorite horror movies and set up his evil clown service in Lucerne. And he says his unlikely new venture is going so well that he's laughing all the way to the bank. After he is hired to scare a birthday boy or girl, he first contacts his victims to tell them they're being watched. Then he taunts them with texts, phone calls, booby-trapped letters warning them that at some time in their party, he's going to show up to smash a cake into their face. It's all fun, he says. If at any point the kids get scared or their parents are concerned, we simply stop right there. Most kids absolutely love being scared senseless. The whole story's there at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Stephen Martin joins us. Full program now as we talk about cosmic conversations, dialogues on the nature of the universe, and the search for reality. Get ready for this Coast to Coast ride. And this has all the makings of a classic Coast to Coast show tonight. Stephen Martin, he's an astronomer, educator, writer. He's worked for the Space Telescope Science Institute and has also been the supervisor of the Williams College Observatory, where he participated in research expeditions around the world to study and observe solar eclipses. With a background in both science and the humanities, he has also been active in exploring and promoting approaches to the universe. Here he is, full program tonight, Steve Martin on Coast to Coast. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good, and we're going to have a couple other guests join you next hour as well. I'm looking forward to this. I just wanted to get your reaction very quickly to President Obama's intended announcement tomorrow on NASA and the budget. What's your gut tell you about the space program? Where should we go, Stephen, if it were up to you?
Well, I think we should go, you know, as far out into the universe as we can. I mean, I think we need the space program. There's so many benefits, both in terms of jobs and spinoffs. And it's also really the cutting edge of human exploration of the universe. So, you know, I'm for taking it as far as we can. I mean, let's go to the moon, let's go to Mars, and let's keep going further beyond.
Absolutely. We need that goal. Tell me a little bit about Cosmic Conversations.
Well, Cosmic Conversations is essentially a collection of interviews with people in very different fields, asking them the question, you know, what is the universe? And so when I wrote the book, I took the perspective that the universe is so complex, so profound, so mysterious, we need lots of different perspectives just to start to get a handle on it. And so what I did was I interviewed some of the most cutting-edge scientists in the world about their ideas. I interviewed religious leaders, spiritual teachers, indigenous elders, and cultural creatives, those men and women who are really at the very edge of transformative culture, and ask them about their beliefs, their ideas about the universe, just to try to get a handle on, well, what is this reality that we're all a part of? How do we see it so differently and yet, you know, live in the same universe?
Did you get some of the answers you were looking for, Stephen, when you talked to them?
Well, I got some answers, but mostly I got, you know, more questions.
Yeah. Right?
Of course, you know, as all good science, you know, leads to is more questions about what we're actually involved with here. But it was certainly a fun ride, and we just had some wonderful conversations. And I try to make the book as accessible as possible, just like you're sitting around the fire asking questions about the universe.
And when you were talking to them, the scientists especially, did any of them come across with the thoughts of spirituality? In terms of what might have happened and what jump-started the universe, or did they take it from a strictly scientific approach?
Well, scientists are very human that way, and that some did and some didn't. One of the people I interviewed was the astrophysicist Bernard Haich, who I believe has also been on the show as well.
Mm-hmm.
Before he went into science, he actually studied for the seminary, and so he has this deep faith, this deep spirituality, combined with this rigorous scientific approach. And so he asked the question, you know, well, what is it that actually got the whole ball rolling? What actually started the universe? And, you know, for him, it's part of the evidence that that God exists. So that's one perspective. And, you know, other scientists are a little bit more tentative about going, you know, before the Big Bang, saying, well, we can only go as far as the science tells us, and beyond that, it's metaphysics. So I think you get the full spectrum of scientists and their beliefs as well. But in general, they're very open to the dialogue between science and spirituality. There's a lot of, you know, good interface happening now.
Did many of them talk about the multiverses as well now, the possibility that we have more than one universe?
Yeah, I mean, that's becoming, you know, more and more accepted, even though it's still speculative, in physics, that perhaps we actually live in a multiverse, and ours is maybe one of very many universes out there. And so now the question is, well, how is it that we actually ended up in the lucky one, the one that actually had the conditions just right for life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did we get that lucky?
Exactly. I mean, we hit the jackpot in terms of the universe we ended up in. So
during your course of interviewing these people, Stephen, did you come across any surprises or curveballs that you didn't expect from them?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's just the nature of having, you know, good, deep conversations. The people who I found were the most surprising, the most different, were the indigenous elders, just because their view, their take on the universe is just so different than ours and very different than what I was expecting. And so talking with them was, you know, a constant series of surprises. But, oh, that's the universe for you. I was like, oh, that's what it's like. So just fascinating. And I think these are very necessary conversations we need to have is with the indigenous peoples of the world as well.
Tell me some of the things they talked about, those elders.
Well, the one thing that, you know, indigenous people really get is interrelatedness. In other words, that our effects on the universe come back to us. There's a reciprocity. And I think that's something we need to recognize, especially with, you know, the ecological and financial and cultural crises that the Western world is engaged in. We need to recognize that it's an interrelated universe, that there are repercussions to our actions. And for them, it's very natural. They really get that at a deep level, that you know, our actions have consequences.
That's so true. Stay with us. Stephen Martin, our special guest tonight. Full 4 hours. A couple guests join us next hour as well, followed by your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And throughout the evening, a couple special guests will be joining us along with Stephen Martin as we talk about cosmic conversations. You know, it's a collection, as he said, of interviews with scientists, spiritual teachers, indigenous peoples, and cultural creatives that explores and expands ideas about the nature of the universe and our role in it. What is that role? More with Stephen Martin when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're with astronomer Stephen Martin, Cosmic Conversation. Stephen, how did you enjoy talking with former Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell for your work?
Oh, wonderful. I mean, he's a very generous conversationalist, and we had a fabulous discussion, both about his trip to the moon and the insights he had on the return trip, where he had this deep, profound experience of the universe, which many people know about, but which changed his life forever.
He experimented with consciousness, and you are absolutely correct. It did change his life forever, to the point where he went on to put together the Noetic Institute, and he hasn't stopped yet. He keeps going. He's got a lot of energy.
He certainly does, and he's just fascinated with the universe, and he's still pushing the boundaries. I mean, even, you know, in his retirement, he's still, you know, actively working and writing and still engaged in this idea about, you know, what are we involved with the universe?
He was telling me about a year or so ago that he wanted to beat John Glenn's record and be the oldest man to go back into space, and he was thinking of trying to get on a shuttle launch. I don't think that's going to happen now, but he wanted it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to see him up there. I mean, he's still in great shape, but he's certainly a hero, and you know, I'd like to see him recognized.
As you were putting together Cosmic Conversations, what important themes kept emerging from your work, from the book?
Well, one interesting insight that came about in pretty much every conversation I had was the insight, which seems obvious, is that we don't necessarily live in the universe, because we actually are the universe. You know, we are the universe in human form. And I think, you know, you may say, well, that's just a word or two, but it's a whole different perspective, you know, to go from thinking about you're in the universe, like you're walking around in a large space or a large box, to actually recognizing we are the universe, you know, occurring in every moment.
I mean, I think the ancients knew this a long, long time ago.
They certainly did, and we seem to have forgotten it along the way. We seem to have distanced ourselves from the universe. Modern culture seems to think that we somehow live on top of nature, that we're somehow separate from it. But the data, you know, and this is scientific data, shows that, you know, our bodies, the elements in our bodies come from the stars. We are literally stardust, you know, that's become self-aware and self-conscious. And so, you know, the story of science tells a very different story than our current culture does.
I'm almost at a point, Stephen, where I'm moving beyond now, trying to figure out who are we, what are we, and just accept the fact that we are, and move on and try to make it work.
I agree. I mean, we're at a place now where we really have to leave behind our old ideas about what the human is and what the universe is, and we need new language. I mean, our language was created at a time when we had certain beliefs about the universe, which are no longer true. And so we have to now start coming up with new words. So it's a very exciting time. It's a very creative time. You know, I think we need, poets as well as physicists to start talking about, you know, what is the universe in the broadest terms.
Did this group of scientists, spiritual leaders, elders, theologians, cultural people, did they talk about life beyond our planet? Do they believe in extraterrestrial life out there in the universe?
I think many of them do, at least, you know, are hopeful that we might discover it one day. I mean, after all, it's a very big universe, and we know that life has shown up on this precious planet called Earth. So if not here, then why not elsewhere? But the fact that we haven't discovered it yet, or at least, you know, not conclusively, you know, at least in the scientific mainstream, might have important consequences for, you know, thinking about how we actually act on the Earth. Because if we're it, if we're the only, you know, life in this part of the galaxy, then that's a very precious thing. Life may not be common at all, And so the decisions we make as humans in terms of the direction of the Earth's evolution are very, very important.
Well, you know, I guess there is that possibility that we are it in the universe, but I don't think so.
I don't either. I think it's very unlikely. Yeah.
At what point in your career as an astronomer, as an educator, when did you start thinking there's probably a little bit more out there than meets the eye?
I think I always felt that way. I mean, ever since I was a kid, just looking up at the stars, I mean, just that natural wonder just came bubbling up in me. And, you know, standing under the night sky, you know, in the Everglades of South Florida, I grew up in South Florida, where there's just gorgeous skies, you know, I knew that's what I wanted to study. You know, it was a calling for me. And just that sense of wonder, it's like, oh, I've got to find out what this is.
I never had any doubts at all, Stephen, as a youngster, about life out there. I never had any proof, but I never doubted the possibility that it was real, that there were other beings living out there. And it fueled me. It pushed me. And I never stopped. For some reason, I'm convinced now that there's a great number of us on this planet when we're born that we then possess this belief system of extraterrestrial life, of spirituality, of consciousness, which we'll talk about in a second here. I think it comes automatic to us.
I think it's very natural. I mean, it's part of being human is having the sense of wonder and the sense of knowing and speculating. And I think you're quite right. I think many of us actually do feel that way.
Many of the people you interviewed talked about consciousness and how it relates to the universe. Let's talk about that for a second. Did any of their views surprise you at all?
Well, it's surprising, I think, in general, that you know, consciousness is needed to actually explain the universe fully. We didn't actually know this in physics until we discovered, you know, quantum mechanics, right? Which basically suggests that we need consciousness as a way of understand the universe at a very deep level. In other words, there's something like, you know, mind or consciousness which seems to be woven into the fabric of the universe. Now, what that means fully, we don't know, but it seems to be a necessary ingredient. Not just in the spiritual traditions, which are very familiar with consciousness from sort of, you know, an inner perspective.
Right.
But in something as, you know, rigorous and scientific and mathematical as quantum physics. Something mysterious like consciousness or mind comes into the equation. I think that's absolutely fascinating.
Do they believe that consciousness is an essential part, an ingredient in how the universe functions?
I think many of the people at the cutting edge are taking that view in more and more. It's still not quite the view in mainstream science, which believes that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain. You know, not regarding the results from quantum physics. But I think it's a view that's coming more and more into science that, you know, maybe consciousness goes all the way down. Maybe it's there at the very foundations of reality as well. And maybe everything around us has a certain degree of consciousness. I mean, this is what the indigenous people say, is that everything has consciousness, everything has life. It's just the degree to which it actually manifests that.
You know, I guess some people would call consciousness God. Other people would just call it this ether in the universe. Whatever it is, it does play this incredible role out there. And I think more and more mainstream scientists are beginning to realize that there is more out there than what they were taught in college and in school many years ago themselves.
I think so. And I think it's hard to sort of let go of the worldview you grew up in, in order to let, you know, the new data about the universe come in. And, you know, scientists are human as well, and they struggle with these same questions, these same biases, these same ideas about, you know, what the universe is and who we are in it. So I think you're quite right that way.
What percent discuss the Big Bang theory and believe that the universe started with that kind of Big Bang?
Well, I mean, that's still the majority of the astronomical view, is that, you know, it began in this singular event, you know, some 13.7 billion years ago. Now, there's still, you know, alternatives to the Big Bang, which are out there. But by and large, I think most people are convinced of, at least for now, that the Big Bang is a good theory.
What are the possibilities, Stephen, that there wasn't this Big Bang beginning, but it always was here? Everything was always here. You know, maybe the solar system formed when it did 4.5 billion years ago, but that this universe, that, you know, this thing, whatever it is, was always here, that there was no Big Bang. Possible?
Well, I mean, that's kind of like the traditional explanation. I mean, that's sort of the view that Einstein grew up with, is that the universe is as it is because it's always been here, right? It's eternal and has always been present. In fact, the well-known astronomer Fred Hoyle had, you know, a competing theory to the Big Bang, which is a theory of continuous creation, that the cosmos is constantly coming into creation each moment, and that gives us the appearance that it's evolving.
Will we ever get that answer, the scientific answer about the formation of the universe?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, with the Large Hadron Collider coming back online, we're sort of pushing the energy boundary back further and further, closer and closer to that, you know, time zero beginning. And so who knows? I mean, we may need a whole new brand of physics to actually understand the conditions that happened at the Big Bang. Because as many people know, you know, our current theories about space, time, and physics break down at the instant just before the beginning, or I mean just, you know, just after the beginning. And so we can't actually know the beginning directly with our physics. We may need a new extra-dimensional physics to actually understand that.
When you interviewed the scientists now, primarily for your work, The Cosmic Conversations, did any of them say anything that was so off the wall, so novel?
Oh, gosh, good question. Well, you know, Fred Allen Wolf and I had a great conversation about the universe and just how the universe does not like being put in a box, right? I mean, just one of the goals of science is to sort of figure out, well, what are the constraints for how the universe operates? And every time we sort of think about, well, this is what the universe is, it just basically explodes the box and says, no, I'm much more than that. And so we were both basically laughing that, you know, perhaps the universe is just, you know, at play, having fun with us, really, you know, tricking us into thinking we actually know something about it.
And then it changes.
Exactly, exactly.
You had a chance to talk with Dr. Dean Radin, of course, who's been a regular on Coast to Coast, and I think just one of the foremost researchers in consciousness, he's one of the best.
He certainly is, and I think his research is just so important in terms of challenging the current paradigm and giving us new insights about what may actually be going on.
Stephen, how did you go about selecting the people that you interviewed?
Well, I had a certain, you know, core group that I knew were really at the cutting edge and that I was really drawn to. And then as I started doing research, you know, and reading their books and reading their work, you know, other names kept popping up. It's like, oh, I've got to interview them. Oh, I have to interview them. So it grew very naturally and very organically. And you know, right now I think it's a very coherent whole. I really like the way the book came together and the interactions between all the different ideas expressed in the interviews.
It looks like a History Channel television program to me. And I hope you go in that direction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, just both the quality of the interviews and the quality of the material and just the fascinating topics we talk about are really, really transformative. I mean, I think people's views of the universe will actually be changed after they read this book.
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and we were talking about this planet. And, you know, we're heavy into alternative medicine. We talk a lot about it on this program. And, you know, I am so mystified in a positive way about how this planet, for example, seems to have cures for just about every ailment or disease in the form of plants, especially. And if there are some diseases out there we don't have cures for, like cancer, I'm convinced the planet has it. We just haven't found it yet. But I don't understand, and this is what's so perplexing to me, Stephen, how this planet can have a plant that you can then use to fight off illness, disease, ailments. I mean, it's like it all fits together, doesn't it?
Isn't it incredible? I mean, how it all works so seamlessly together. And I think we've really underestimated, you know, just the vastness and intelligence of nature. We think that we're the smartest thing around. But, you know, remember, we come from, you know, a universe that gave birth to us. And I think we continue to underestimate what that actually means.
Well, and of course, the Gaia theory that this planet is alive, it's breathing, it's an organism all to itself. I believe that. When you think about these remedies, that they're here on the planet, all you got to do is find them. It's like the planet saying, okay, so I know that there's this disease out there, but we have this remedy over here. You two have to put it together and make it work. It's just too logical. Now, my friend said, folks, it's God. God has done this. He's the one. It's the one that has made all this stuff available. Maybe he's right too.
Yeah, exactly. We can both be right. And I think you're so correct in that, you know, diseases and the cures for them, I think, maybe go together. I mean, indigenous peoples know this. I mean, they naturally, you know, have these conversations with the universe, with Gaia, as we said. And they find out, you know, what healing is needed for this disease. Well, they go into trance or they take plant medicines and they get information about what's needed. So there's a conversation that they're having with the natural world. And once again, they're not separate. There's this deep interrelatedness. And I think that's something that we need to learn as Western peoples, is how to relate more intimately with nature and with the universe.
In your career, what has been one of the most perplexing things you've faced, or answers that you've been looking for that you just can't find?
Well, what came up for me in my research was this mystery of dark matter. I mean, that was one of my specialties, was in extragalactic studies of dark matter. I mean, here is this something, and we don't know if even matter is the right word for it, something which is shaping the very origin, evolution, and destiny of the universe through its gravitational influence, and yet we have no idea what it is. I think that's just unbelievably mind-blowing. And then on top of that, this discovery of dark energy, right, which is causing acceleration. So now we're at the point where 96% of the universe is this dark matter and dark energy, and yet we have no idea what it is, which leaves us with, you know, the 4% that we can actually see. I think that's just, you know, very profound.
What is it, Stephen, that is going to give us the answers that we're looking for? Technology? I mean, what is creating this evolution of knowledge for us?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, maybe technology will do it. Maybe we need to think, you know, much more broadly about the nature of the universe. Maybe there's other ideas that we need to seriously consider. You know, other dimensions, spirituality, consciousness. Maybe we need to think, you know, a lot more broadly about the nature of the universe, because so far, you know, science has told us that we're aware of, you know, 4%. And who knows if there's even more beyond that.
Well, exactly. It could be much more than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, where is the book available, Cosmic Conversations?
The book is widely available at bookstores and, of course, you know, online retailers such as Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I always like to encourage people to support their local independent bookstore, and it's widely available through all the independent bookstores as well.
Of all the contributors that you interviewed, all of them, was there one that stood out beyond the others?
Oh, boy, it's like, you know, trying to choose a favorite child. Every interview is unique and precious in its own way. You know, I had a deep resonance with the first person I interviewed, who is the cosmologist Brian Swim. He has this wonderful way.
He's the mathematician, right?
He's a mathematical cosmologist.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just a very profound thinker about, you know, what is the universe and what is our role in it. And, you know, I know him personally, and so we've had many, you know, fruitful discussions along this way, but we just had a wonderful way of talking about it.
All right. Well, up next, one of your experts joins us. And then another one a little bit later on Coast to Coast AM.